Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on critical condition when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what Professor Nielsen had to say about your lawyer. He said, it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. He said, it's worse than that. He said, most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for that free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. It seems that America, and indeed the rest of the world right along with us, are embroiled in one catastrophic problem after another. Here in America, we're concerned about things like Social Security. Our Social Security system is a Ponzi scheme that's faced with bankruptcy. Our pension systems in the United States are on the skids. The dollar is on the slide. Health care is a problem. Obesity, Medicare. We're concerned and worried about Iraq, Afghanistan, the draft, North Korea and the bomb and peak oil, and the problems that go on and on and on. You know, they're reported on the news every night, 6 o'clock. It's like a dirge. Many people don't want to watch the news because it's only bad news. Healthcare is a problem here in the United States. They tell us that 44 million Americans don't have healthcare insurance. I'm one of them. I avoid healthcare insurance like I avoid AIDS, herpes, and venereal disease. I go out of my way to avoid healthcare insurance. I stay away from doctors and hospitals. Those are places to die, and doctors are dangerous people that kill 130,000 people a year from what we call iatrogenic disease in this country. That's doctor-induced death. It's where the doctor cuts out the wrong lung, cuts off the wrong leg, prescribes the wrong medicine, or the wrong dosage. And that's what they admit to, $130,000 a year. The real number is double that. It's more like $250,000. But if we just take the government's own numbers, they kill 130,000 people a year. And that's, as I said, what they admit to. Critical Condition, a book written by Donald Bartlett and James Steele, exposes the underpinnings of the healthcare system in the United States. And I would submit to you that probably the healthcare system of Canada, of Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, probably in India and China as well. And that's because medicine has been taken over by big business. Medicine isn't the old country doctor who comes out to the house to help your wife in childbirth. Medicine is big business, and it generates billions of dollars in stocks and bonds and in mergers and business takeovers. Doctors that make millions of dollars a year in their specialties and create clinics that make more millions of dollars for their clinics and corporations and staffs. Let's take a look at the labyrinth of care that we have here in the United States and look into Critical Condition. Well, Margaret Utterback had just come out of the bathroom of her home in San Leandro, California, on the morning of January 26, 1996, when the pain hit. It was a sharp stab in the back, radiating along the right side toward her abdomen. Utterback wondered if she had hurt her back the day before when she sat in a hard chair. Or was it the shellfish that she had eaten the night before? She was 74 years old and in reasonably good health, but the pain was so intense that when it persisted, she called her daughter Barbara Winnie at 8:15 a.m. and asked if she would come over. Utterback then placed a call to her primary care doctor at the Kaiser Permanente Clinic in nearby Hayward, California, to seek an appointment. At the Kaiser Hospital, the patient for 50 years, Utterback, had been with this healthcare system now for half a century. Utterback had been dealing with the health plans clinic for decades. However, the call she made that morning did not go to the clinic she had used for years. Instead, it was automatically forwarded to another location, a Kaiser call center that had taken over the task of scheduling doctor's appointments and dealing with other medical matters that were previously handled by the clinics. So Utterback got a recorded message and was placed on hold. When no one answered for what seemed like an interminable time, she hung up. Her daughter Barbara arrived at 9:30 a.m. and found her mother in bed, still wearing her pajamas and in pain. At 9:45 a.m., they placed a second call to Kaiser, this time getting through to a real person. Utterback told of her symptoms and asked for an appointment. The woman at the call center said her doctor was booked that day and could not see her. Utterback again explained that she was in pain and asked if she could at least be put through to her doctor to discuss it. The woman said she could not do that, and she suggested that Utterback call back at 3 p.m. and then request an urgent care appointment for that evening. Frustrated now, the two women considered what to do next. Utterback attempted one more time to get an appointment. She placed a third call to Kaiser and again described her symptoms to the clerk. After being transferred, she found herself talking with a woman at 10:15 a.m. who at least seemed sympathetic and who offered to send an email message to Utterback's physician to ask if she could be seen that day. In the meantime, Utterback was to wait for a call back. Utterback and her daughter did just that. They waited through the lunch hour, certain that they would hear any minute from her doctor. When they didn't, the pain intensified. Utterback could wait no longer. At 1:45 p.m., she telephoned the Kaiser call center to check on her status. Again, she explained to yet one more anonymous voice at the other end why she was calling, that she was in intense pain, that for hours she had tried repeatedly to make an appointment with her doctor, and that she was distressed because she couldn't get to see someone. As before, she was transferred several times until she was referred to a unit called patient assistance. When that turned out to be another voicemail recording, Utterback hung up in despair. She called back. Her fifth call of the day, she was connected to a new clerk, and again she told her story. She was shuttled back and forth on the phone until various clerks finally arranged an appointment for 4:15 p.m. with her doctor at the Point Eden Clinic in Hayward. Utterback and her doctor didn't wait. They left for the clinic at once, arriving at 2:45 p.m., where they sat until 4:30 p.m. According to California records, once her physician, Dr. Rod Perry, finally examined Utterback, he immediately diagnosed the pain, an abdominal aortic aneurysm. The condition, which kills some 15,000 people a year, is brought on by a weakness in the wall of the aortic artery that causes the vessel to swell. If the artery ruptures, the patient can quickly bleed to death. In Utterback's case, the doctor concluded that the blood vessel had already split apart. Even so, it was an hour before the clinic managed to get the endangered patient transferred by ambulance to nearby Hayward Hospital. By then, she was so racked by pain that she was thrashing about on the gurney. Minutes after she was wheeled into the emergency room at 5:31 p.m., 9 hours after she first sought medical help, her abdominal aorta, I guess that's pronounced. Utterback's blood pressure crashed as blood gushed out of the artery and emptied into her body. She was rushed to surgery, and for the next 5 hours, doctors attempted to repair the damage. She was bleeding so badly that doctors gave her 24 pints of blood. Afterward, in grave condition, she was moved to the critical care unit and hooked up to a heart-lung machine while physicians and nurses frantically tried to raise her blood pressure. She never fully regained consciousness, and in the hours that followed, her only communication with her stunned family was when she gently squeezed the hands of two of her daughters. At 5:45 on the morning of January 28th, 36 hours after she underwent surgery, Margaret Utterback died. Now, when the California Department of Managed Health Care investigated her death, the agency concluded that Kaiser had failed Margaret Utterback at every stage, starting with the call center and ending in the physician's office. Calling it a systemic breakdown, the department levied a $1 million fine against the Kaiser Foundation health plan for neglecting to provide basic health care services, including preventive care and emergency services. Kaiser said it would vigorously contest the finding, but in 2002, after a court ruled against it, Kaiser agreed to pay the fine. The largest ever assessed by the California Managed Care Agency, and in 2003 the health plan paid $1.1 million into California's general fund. We're now dealing with the new bureaucrats. And every day, thousands of Americans pick up a telephone and become entangled in the faceless bureaucracy of healthcare. They deal with endless voicemail options. They get passed from person to person, and they wait. They're advised to call back. They're told that people they need to speak with are unavailable, and often the calls are about simple matters. You know, a doctor's appointment, a bill, a question about insurance coverage, requests for referrals. But woven throughout these basic queries are the life and death calls from the Margaret Utterbacks. And how many of the critical pleas for help are processed with the same type of indifference as a request for a new insurance card? It's anybody's guess. Nor has any government agency or regulatory body ever thought or sought to find out. The mistakes are buried in the bureaucracy, which excels at consuming the time of callers while delaying and denying requests for treatment. Now, since the 1980s, America's healthcare bureaucracy has mushroomed into one of the nation's fastest growing industries. But this new industry is not designed to serve consumers, nor to improve the delivery of medical services. Rather, it is being driven solely by the need to manage the process of referrals, billing, and reimbursements among the nation's thousands of healthcare and health plans. To do so, it uses an army of call center clerical workers, claims processing agents, software developers, private contractors who manage medical back offices, and on-site accounting personnel who track claims for doctors' offices and hospitals. Hundreds of thousands of people are part of the bureaucracy that has evolved from insurers' efforts to deny, discourage, or to postpone care, and to shift more of the expense to consumers. At best, it's a costly and wasteful system that siphons off precious healthcare dollars, and at worst, it causes injury and death. Now, it wasn't supposed to be that way. For-profit healthcare wasn't sold to the American public on this basis. When market-based medicine began to take hold in the 1980s, the idea was that it would modernize the field and reduce spending. Now, introducing business-like practices, the theory went, would streamline healthcare and contain costs. But defying the collective wisdom of America's business schools, just the opposite has happened. A massive bureaucracy has grown up to administer an ever more intricate matrix of health plans and their myriad provisions, wasting an ever larger share of healthcare dollars in the paperwork factory that would be the dream of a 1950s Soviet bureaucrat. Members of this new bureaucracy have job descriptions and professional organizations that didn't exist 25 years ago. When patients were on a first-name basis with the person who answered the doctor's telephone, the American Academy of Professional Coders is a national organization dedicated to training medical coders to help doctors and hospitals obtain proper reimbursement for their services. When its 35,000 members were invited to the annual convention, thousands came, like those who flocked to Hawaii in 2003. Now, in the past, before battles between doctors and insurers over fees and reimbursements reached epidemic proportions, there was very little need for such a group. The Professional Association of Healthcare Reimbursement Specialists is another group. Its theme at a recent convention was the reimbursement jungle. Neither was there a National Association for Claims Assistant Professionals, or an American Medical Billing Association, or a Professional Association of Healthcare Office Managers. Medical billing in the United States has become a regulatory policy guideline nightmare, or so observed one Canadian healthcare writer. His name is Henry Sporn. He said, "It's impossible for any single individual to keep up with all of the guidelines and policies and payment practices that pertain to an individual specialty." Adding to the cost is the structure of the industry. While everyone recognizes the names Aetna and Humana, there are only two, or these rather, only two of the more than 1,000 healthcare plans. Each has its own guidelines covering what it will pay, how long a patient may be hospitalized, and what medical conditions require referrals, and how much time a doctor may devote to a patient. And because most physicians participate in multiple plans, their employees must know the requirements of each, thereby adding additional layers to this administrative labyrinth of processes and procedures that few understand. And what's more, every health insurer offers multiple plans with varying deductibles and options. Medical researchers in Seattle found that insurers in that area offered some 755 different health care insurance products. Now, in any other industries, such a variety of choices would be great for consumers. Competition in automobiles, for instance, or electronics and apparel has worked wonders to provide good quality and low prices. But in healthcare, the multiplicity of plans hasn't helped consumers at all because most people actually have very few choices. Those who have health coverage usually must join one of a handful of plans selected by their employer or dictated by where they happen to live. So unlike buying a cat or a car, you can't shop around for the best deal on the model of your choice. So in the end, while every plan follows a unique set of guidelines and procedures, each does pretty much the same thing. All major plans have their own call centers, claims operations, and reimbursement formulas, so the bureaucracy isn't able to take advantage of the economies of scale. Rather than becoming efficient, it has instead created vast overlap, duplication, and waste. And though the United States pioneered the information revolution, the multitude of health plans, excess competition, if you will, has created one more bizarre phenomenon. Most computers within the industry are unable to talk to one another. Think of an elementary school classroom with 24 students, each speaking a distinct language, unable to understand what the other 23 are saying, and the teacher insisting on keeping it that way. Well, currently, healthcare institutions that wish to communicate electronically have to no standard way of doing so, and according to the Massachusetts Health Data Consortium, hundreds of thousands of health care providers and payers use their own systems, many of which are based on proprietary data and sets that are confusing to other organizations. And a white paper by the Information Technology Association of America says that the healthcare industry fragmentation represents a significant barrier to the widespread adoption of networks. The diversity of participants in the healthcare industry and the complexity of their relationships with each other have frustrated the voluntary adoption of any uniform industry standards. Doctors and hospitals deal with the consequences of this every day. For them, it means spending more time and money on administration and paperwork, and less time on patients. And it also markedly increases the risk of patient mistakes, known in the trade as iatrogenic disease. Now, Musette Batras was 6 months pregnant when she suddenly felt an all-too-familiar pain. For years, she had suffered periodic attacks of Crohn's disease and often debilitating inflammation of the intestine. Sometimes medication brought it under control, but occasionally the attacks were so severe that she required hospitalization. This was one of those times. On March 19, 1996, in agony and worried over how the flare-up might affect her unborn child, Battis was rushed to the Winthrop University Hospital in Mineola, New York, near her Long Island home. After being admitted, she was told that her health insurer, the Prudential, would authorize only a one-night stay. The next day, when her symptoms persisted, her doctor recommended that she remain in the hospital until the attack subsided. But 2 days later, Batras, still in pain, was told that a Prudential nurse, without consulting her doctor, had reviewed her chart and concluded that further hospitalization was not medically necessary. So Batras was told that she would either have to leave the hospital immediately or pay for subsequent days out of her own pocket. For her, there was really no option. I could not afford the hospitalization, she said later. Still suffering and frightened about the health of her baby, Batras checked herself out of the hospital, and soon she would be back, more scared and sicker than ever. The person who determines how long you stay in a hospital may not be your doctor. Your health insurer usually has the last word on how long you're going to stay in the hospital, and to make that decision, many insurers rely on a set of little-known but widely used manuals that spell out in detail how many days a patient with a particular condition should be hospitalized. double bypass heart surgery, 4 days. Pneumonia, 2 days. Gallbladder removal, 1 day. Stroke, 1 day. And these insurers also use these guidelines to decide whether a specialist should be called in, whether to approve a physician's request to perform surgery, or whether hospitalization is needed for a procedure and for how long, and even whether the procedure should be performed at all. The guidelines have been translated into computer programs so that a health plan's employees, in deciding whether a patient's hospital stay should be extended, can quickly access the information and cut off payment if the patient exceeds the specified norm. With the rise of free market medicine, this kind of control became inevitable, as health care has been converted into just another profit-making enterprise. Insurers have sought to impose more rigorous controls on doctors and hospitals to reduce the time that patients spend in those hospitals. Decisions that once were left solely in the hands of physicians evaluating a patient's condition, determining the need for surgery, and deciding how long a patient should be hospitalized became opportunities to shave costs. And by setting strict targets that restrict hospital stays and by keeping pressure on doctors and nurses to abide by those guidelines, insurers hold down costs and fatten their own bottom lines. It's nothing personal, it's just business. The drafting and implementing of these guidelines, as well as appeals from them by physicians and hospitals, involve hundreds of millions of healthcare dollars every year. Money that could and should go into patient care, but instead that money now feeds the bureaucracy, the burgeoning healthcare bureaucracy, the one that has been spawned, ironically, to control these costs that are spiraling out of control. That's the results of socialized medicine. Now, so exactly who wrote the guidelines that led to Maset Batra's discharge from the hospital while she was still in pain and sent her home? Well, a Seattle-based actuarial and employee benefits consulting firm. It was Milliman USA that wrote those guidelines. Milliman is the dominant player in this little-known guidelines field and is typical of many private companies that have capitalized on opportunities to profit from the chaos that has developed and enveloped healthcare. Milliman's guidelines are now used by health plans that cover more than 100 million Americans. In the company's own words, few areas of American life have changed as much as healthcare delivery. And Milliman has been at the center of that upheaval. For much of its half-century-plus history, the Milliman Company had very little more than a passing interest in healthcare. The company developed actuarial tables for pension funds and calculated risk for life and property insurers. It wasn't until 1990 that the company, then known as Milliman and Robertson, moved into healthcare in a big way, with inpatient and surgical care, the first of a series of path-breaking volumes that showed insurers how to enforce shorter hospital stays in these fields. As health insurers sought to justify their cost-cutting, the guidelines were, as one Milliman executive put it, the right idea at the right place at the right time. 7 guidebooks followed on other subjects, including outpatient care, case management, and pediatrics. Everyone has been controversial. Doctors call Milliman's guidelines cookbook medicine for what they consider a simplistic view of patient care that doesn't reflect the real world. Their chief complaint is that Milliman calls for such and much shorter hospital stays than many doctors believe are necessary to treat certain conditions. Milliman recommended that mastectomies be performed on an outpatient basis and that congestive heart failure patients be hospitalized for only 1 day or less. For vaginal births, 24 hours in the hospital was their standard, and for a cesarean, 48 hours. Both the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Pediatric Society have strongly disagreed, saying that the minimum hospitalization for both types of births should be doubled. The company's most infamous recommendation, though few in the public connected to the Milliman name, also involved childbirth. That was the so-called drive-through deliveries, in which Milliman advocated same-day delivery and discharge for mothers and newborns. Eventually, 41 states and the federal government passed laws to ban outpatient deliveries. Milliman also once proposed that elderly people with cataracts receive surgery in only one eye because seeing in both eyes wasn't essential. A public outcry forced the company to backtrack on that cost-cutting ploy. Many doctors don't object to the idea of guidelines. They just believe that Milliman's are too stringent. They say the company's suggested stays are unrealistic because they reflect best-case scenarios, relatively simple cases with no complications. For its part, Milliman insists the guidelines are based on reviews of scientific literature, medical charts, consultations with physicians, and up-to-date evidence. But study after study by physicians, medical schools, and researchers has concluded the exact opposite. Well, hang on, boys and girls. We're reviewing the book In Critical Condition by Donald Bartlett and James Steele, published by Doubleday in New York. Critical Condition. More to come right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program and often endorses and recommends books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we do give do not mean that the authors or publishers so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may or may not be endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review and vice versa. Remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book, Critical Condition. Donald Bartlett, spelled B-A-R-L-E-T-T, and James Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E, published by Doubleday of New York. Fairly new book. I think it's copyrighted 2004. Let me just look here quickly. When was this thing published? Yep, November 2004. So we're talking about a brand new book. Probably pick it up at Barnes & Noble. Well worth reading. We won't be able to cover everything that's in the book. We're taking a look here at the labyrinth of healthcare. Healthcare and healthcare insurance is big news these days. Everybody's talking about their inability, or at least the inability of 44 million Americans to secure healthcare insurance. I'm one of those. I don't have any healthcare insurance at all, and I avoid it like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Now, a surgeon in Durham, North Carolina, his name, Dr. Robert Rutledge, reviewed North Carolina hospital discharge records for adults who underwent surgery in 25 categories and concluded that the Milliman guidelines were at wide variance from the actual length of stay of patients treated for these diseases. And Dr. Rutledge warned that the guidelines, if they were enforced across the board, would definitely hurt some patients. Similarly, a national study of trauma patients by the Wake Forest University School of Medicine showed that Milliman's hospital stays bore very little relationship to the length of time that trauma patients actually spend in a hospital. Using data from 85,000 patients in the National Trauma Data Bank, the researchers found that Milliman grossly underestimates the length of stay observed in patients from the NTDB patients. In the NTDB who actually met Milliman guidelines, and they had a significantly higher mortality than did those whose LOS was over Milliman's specified length of stay. In other words, a considerable percentage of the patients who left the hospital on the Milliman abbreviated timetable were those who died. Again, it's nothing personal. It's just business. And Milliman says that its guidelines are only tools in medical decision-making to help hospitals and physicians identify the norm in tracking a patient's progress. Yet Milliman also asserts that quality care can be achieved by what it calls minimizing variation. And when variation is reduced, patients are diagnosed and treated quickly and effectively. The company maintains that its goal is to improve patient care and to reduce waste, not to supplant the doctor's decisions with generic guidelines. In no situation are the guidelines intended to be a substitute for sound clinical judgment based on an individual patient's condition. And in a statement that has helped insulate Milliman from the legal wrath of physicians and patients alike, the company claims that any HMO or other provider that uses the guidelines as the sole basis for denying authorization for treatment without proper consideration of the unique characteristics of each patient, or as the sole basis for denying payment for treatment received, is using our care guidelines inappropriately. Those are nice words. Nice words that don't help anybody. But that isn't what's actually happening out there in the workplace. In fact, insurers and HMOs invoke these guidelines inflexibly to save money and to maximize profits. Rather serving as a guide, the manuals have become the Bible for insurers to exert strong pressure on doctors and hospitals to adhere to those guides. And as one New Jersey doctor told the New York Times, the trouble is that rather than becoming a guide, it has now become a crucifix, a cross of gold. Let me pause right here and make an observation. You know, they talk a lot about marketplace economics and medicine. This isn't marketplace economics. This is just private socialization. When the government does it through Medicare, that's socialized medicine. When we do it through private insurance companies, corporations created by government, what you have is socialization of the public sector. Let me show you something. Think about it pragmatically. You buy insurance because you don't want to be responsible for your own health care. So you pay the premiums. And naturally, when you get sick, you want to collect the benefits. After all, your attitude is, I paid for it. Why shouldn't I collect it? The hospital, conversely, has its bills to pay. And then let's say that this hospital has 100 beds in it. And you come into the hospital, and you take up bed number 79. That means that they have a 21% vacancy factor. 21%. Now, the hospital has a financial interest in keeping you in the hospital as long as possible. I mean, after all, If we had 100 beds full, we would be at maximum capacity. We would be generating revenue, making profit at the highest possible level. But we're only operating at 79% of our profitability. Now, the insurance companies aren't stupid, you know. They know that. And they know that the hospitals and doctors are going to keep you in the hospital as long as possible for their own private gain. So the insurance company has to have something that they can lean upon, guideline that they can go upon, so that they can limit that stay. So they've gone to the Milliman guides. That's all. If you went to the hospital, as the two examples here, let's assume that you didn't have any insurance at all. And like this first lady that we were talking about, the 74-year-old lady from San Leandro, California, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion, you had this pain and you don't have any insurance, you hurt real bad, you need to go to the hospital, you wouldn't have even called Kaiser. You see, I came from an era when we didn't have health insurance. You went to the hospital and you made your deal, or you went to your doctor. In my case, it was Dr. Joe Walsh in Eureka, California. I think there were two doctors in town in the 1940s. We had one hospital. Well, we had two. We had the county hospital and general hospital. And then, if you got sick and Joe Walsh told you to go to the hospital, you went to the hospital and it cost you $25 a day. That was pretty heavy duty, because, you know, a man made about $5 to $10 a day working for wages when I was a kid. So you're talking about going to the hospital cost you 2-3 days, maybe up to 5 days wages to go to the hospital. I imagine it's about that way today. You make $100 a day, and a hospital room's probably $300-$400 a day, $500 maybe. So to minimize those costs, we want the health insurance industry, we want the health insurance company to cover that cost for us. We want socialized medicine, and you know what we get? We get just exactly what socialization brings. It means you get to stand in line, share the shortage, and use shoddy products and shoddy workmanship. That's what communism has brought to everyone who's practiced it in the past. Why should communism bring us anything different in the future here in America or Canada or Australia or New Zealand? So what I've done to solve that problem is I've got a little slush fund over here, and if I need something from a doctor or a hospital, I've got some money to pay for it. And if I needed to go to the hospital, I wouldn't waste my time calling a health insurer. I'd just go to the hospital or call the doctor over here in Gainesville and say, here's my problem, doc. And I pay in gold coin. You know, I've never had a doctor tell me yet that he couldn't see me if I told him I pay in gold coin and I don't need a receipt. Well, going on, they report to us that in December of 1998, Milliman issued its eighth and most controversial set of hospital stay guidelines. It's called the Pediatric Health Status Improvement and Management. These guidelines for infants and children outraged many pediatricians for much the same reason that earlier Milliman manuals had provoked an outcry. The suggested length of stays proposed for childhood diseases and illnesses were much too short, in their opinion. A California pediatrician, Gary F. Krieger, told the AMA News that the guidelines were totally irrational for day-to-day use in any event. These guidelines talk about the ideal, and the ideal is not where reality is located. Writing in Pediatrics, three medical doctors at the Boston University School of Medicine, Howard Bochner, Robert Vinci, and John Chesser, contended that the use of Milliman and Robertson as a way to judge appropriate length of stay and to benchmark and compare institutions has absolutely no basis in fact, is not justified, and may lead to suboptimal care. Now, a Baltimore-based healthcare consultant, the HCIA Sachs Institute, reviewed 3.5 million pediatric cases and found that more than two-thirds of the children were hospitalized longer than Milliman recommended for the same illnesses. Overall, the HCIA found a substantial gap between Milliman's suggested stays and how long children actually remained in hospitals. For asthma, Milliman allotted 1 day. Nationally, the median was 2 days, according to HCIA anyway. For bronchitis, bronchiolitis, a lung infection, Milliman also recommended 1 day. The national median was 2 days. For bacterial meningitis, Milliman suggested 3 days of hospitalization. HCIA said the median was 8.5 days. The 55,000-member American Academy of Pediatrics called the pediatric guidelines beyond the realm of reality, and of the Milliman recommendation that children in a coma should be released after 3 days, the Academy noted, it boggles the mind that a patient would be discharged in a coma in 3 days after having been in a coma for 48 hours before with seizures. The pediatrician perhaps most upset by Milliman's guidelines for children was Dr. Thomas G. Clary. He's the head of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Texas, Houston Medical School. When the guidelines were published, Dr. Clary was listed as a contributing author, but he wasn't. Not only had he not contributed, he considered some guidelines dangerous. He would later tell the Houston Chronicle that Milliman's pediatric guidelines were the most outrageous thing that he'd seen in 28 years of practicing pediatric medicine. Dr. Clary had become entangled in a controversy by default. You see, in an attempt to make the guidelines more palatable and to give them wider acceptance, Milliman formed an alliance with the large, well-established pediatrics department of the University of Texas, Houston. Milliman gave the department a grant of $100,000 and then hired one of its faculty members, Dr. Robert Yetman, to oversee compilation and drafting of the guidelines. In early 1998, Yetman sent Clary a list of recommendations for pediatric hospital stays that he planned to include in the upcoming guidebook. Clary said later that he was appalled at their brevity. Kids might die from these guidelines. He jotted down some concerns and then sent them back to Yetman. When Milliman formally released his 400-page pediatric manual in December of 1998, Clary was stunned to see that he was listed as a contributor. Together with other members of his department in the preface, Milliman sought to give the impression that the book had been a joint project with the university's pediatrics department. It read, quote, Milliman and Robertson Incorporated and the University of Texas Houston Medical School Department of Pediatrics are pleased to present Pediatric Health Status Improvement and Management, HSIM, a comprehensive set of health management guidelines created to assist clinicians in the management of pediatric disorders. So after reviewing the manual, Clary concluded that every page contained at least one risky recommendation. Most distressing were the very brief hospital stays suggested for children with major illnesses. For a case of bacterial infection, this is neonatal sepsis, Milliman recommended 3 days. Clary thought 2 to 3 weeks was closer to the norm. For osteomyelitis, a bone infection that Clary said often required 4 to 6 weeks of hospitalization, Milliman recommended 2 days. In 2 days, you may not have the organism isolated. You don't know if it's sensitive to antibiotics. You don't have a clue where you are in 2 days, Clary said. So Clary demanded that his name be dropped from the manual, as did 3 other faculty members, and that Milliman withdraw the manual. Milliman sent out a corrected list of contributors, omitting the names of Clary and the other department members who had protested. Eventually, the pediatrics department itself asked to be disassociated from these guidelines, and Milliman agreed to comply in future editions. But in the meantime, it continued to market this published manual to health insurers and hospitals by the thousands. Cleary and his colleagues subsequently filed a lawsuit seeking to recall the manual. They charged that their reputations had been harmed by linking them to these guidelines for which there is no accepted authoritative medical or scientific basis. Their real aim was to force withdrawal of the guidelines. If the court should agree with them, Cleary said that any award that he received would be donated to charity. Doctors get sued. We don't sue, he told the Houston Chronicle. But in this case, I felt I had no choice. If this lawsuit makes me any money, I'll have to figure out which charity to give it to. I don't want money with blood on it. Musette Batras. Remember the lady that had Crohn's disease, the expectant mother who was discharged from the New York hospital over the objections of her physician when her health insurer invoked the Milliman guidelines? Well, she returned to her home in hopes that the stubborn attack of Crohn's disease would subside so she could enjoy the last 3 months of her pregnancy. But just a week later, Batras was experiencing crippling pain again and running a high fever. Her mother rushed her back to the hospital, this time to the emergency room. The attending physician wanted to perform exploratory surgery to determine the cause of the pain and contacted Prudential for authorization. Now, the doctors felt that Batras was extremely ill and both her life and that her baby were at risk. When her physician heard nothing from Prudential the next day, he called the insurer only to be told that the request was still pending. 2 days later, the authorization to operate still pending, Batras' intestines burst. Without immediate surgery, she would bleed to death. Her physicians could delay no longer. Before moving her to the operating room, they felt obliged to tell Batras that her husband and her husband that there was only a slim chance that the baby would survive. Batras was in the OR for hours, where surgeons removed part of her colon. Miraculously, both she and her unborn baby survived. But her relief was soon tempered by a grim warning from doctors. You see, during this traumatic emergency surgery, the baby might have suffered brain damage. Only time would tell. Now, 4 days after the life-saving operation, Prudential, not to be influenced by Batras' experience, insisted that she be discharged. Her physician was outraged. When he pointed out that his patient was barely out of surgery, was pregnant, and still seriously ill, the insurer backed down. Well, temporarily. You see, a week later, the company ruled that further hospitalization was not medically necessary. So Batras was discharged. A little more than 2 months later, she returned to the hospital and, to the relief and wonder of all, gave birth to a healthy baby girl. One of her doctors, Patrick F. Vettery, believed that Batras had been extremely fortunate, but that didn't temper his deep dissatisfaction with the system, and particularly with the Prudential Insurance Company that had endangered his patient's life and that of her baby. In Dr. Vettery's opinion, relying on third-party guidelines to save money on hospitalization, as the insurer had done in this case, violated acceptable standards of care in the medical community. And had he acted as the insurer did, Dr. Vettery said, I would have committed an act of medical malpractice. Now, nearly one out of every $3 now spent on health care goes for administration. That's $1 out of every $3 that you spend on insurance. $1 out of every $3 that you spend in the hospital. $1 out of every $3 goes to health care administration, not for health care. From processing the voluminous paperwork of billing to enforcing the length of stay guidelines that brought grief to Musette Batras, a generation after introducing business practices to health care, the United States now spends a higher percentage of its health care dollars just to administer the program than any other country in the world. A study published by the New England Journal of Medicine in 2003 compared the administrative costs in the United States and Canada and concluded that the U.S. costs were three times higher than Canada, $1,059 per person in the United States in 1999 versus $307 per capita in Canada. Administrators, clerks, and other members of the bureaucracy comprise an ever-expanding share of the health care workforce, and at the expense of nurses, doctors, and other caregivers. Between 1969 and 1999, the share of U.S. health care and labor force accounted for by the administrative workers grew from 18.2% to 27.3%. Now, that's according to a recent study. Now, in Canada, the increase during that period was 3.1% in Canada. Now, what is most remarkable about these findings is that the study didn't include all of the administrative jobs. The computations intentionally excluded a key sector of the industry, that's 926,000, nearly a million employees in life insurance or health insurance firms, 750,000 in insurance brokerage and employees of consulting firms. These workers were not included for two reasons: to give a more accurate comparison with the Canadian healthcare system, where private insurers are bit players, and because it was impossible to pinpoint how many insurance, consulting, and brokerage employees are specifically engaged in healthcare rather than other types of insurance. So the total number of administrative jobs was greatly understated in this study. And since the study did not count thousands of employees who answer calls or process claims, the very heart of the insurer's bureaucracy, these are absolute parasites on the host. And the study's authors did not attribute the high administrative cost to any one factor, but they noted the growth coincided with the expansion of managed care and market-based competition, which fostered the adoption of complex accounting and auditing practices long standard in the business world. They also pointed out that a system with multiple insurers is intrinsically costlier than a single-payer system, noting that the Canadian physicians and virtually all bills to a single insurer. Through Canada's National Healthcare Program, Canadian hospitals have an annual budget, and they receive lump sum payments from provincial governments. Thereby, they eliminate the cumbersome billing structure of the U.S. hospitals. So they have socialized medicine in Canada, and it's more streamlined than our system here in the United States. The existence of global budgets in Canada has eliminated most billing and minimized the internal cost accounting, since charges do not need to be attributed to individual patients and insurers, they concluded. So while Washington continues to encourage this private bureaucracy by championing this misguided belief that competition in health care will control costs, some states are beginning to see things a little differently. In 2001, the Maine legislature, worried about soaring outlays and the growing numbers of uninsured residents, authorized a study by the Mathematica Policy Research Incorporated, that's of Princeton, to evaluate whether Maine could implement a single-payer system. So in December of 2002, Mathematica concluded that it could be done largely through savings derived by consolidating operations of the state's numerous health plans. Well, I'm about out of time here, boys and girls. We're covering the book Critical Condition by Donald Bartlett and James Steele. We'll be back tomorrow night with more. The book is published by Doubleday of New York. You can probably get a copy at someplace like Amazon.com or any bookstore, I would imagine. Let me put a mark right here in the margin and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. So for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. It says our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.